I was born on the 1st of January, 1888. A long, long time.
Where?
In a little village called the Licky Looky in Russia. And in fact, one of the homes of my grandfather, the home in which we lived, was still there even after the Russian Revolution. The government never took it down. I imagine it was a younger brother of my father who lived there afterwards. He was a federal rabbi. And they must have left it because the children of my uncles must have been active in the movement. The house was first torn down when the Germans invaded Russia at that time. And that was near St. Petersburg. The family belonged to what they called the first privileged class of the Jewish people. My grandfather was a very important man. He never went to school, but he built all the bridges and big buildings in the province. And no important man ever passed that province without stopping into the house to see my grandfather.
When did your family come to the United States?
Well, now, my father afterwards is what they call Lumber King. That's how we happened to live there. Go out into the forest and buy up the whole forest and have the lumber sent down. And I remember when I was about 3 1/2 or 4 years old, my mother called me one day to see my father's lumber coming down the river. And I remember the rafts with the men, you know, shoving them with. We came here in 1893, August 1893. My father left everything behind because his sons were growing up. And my grandfather was dead. The influence of the family had gone with him practically. And in order to save them from going into the army, he left everything behind. We came here. We lived actually in a palatial home. It was the home of a defunct duke. Orchards, our own orchards and our own cows and everything. I remember being taken into the milk shed by the maid, and she put me on a shed there, you know, that held the forage, I guess, and so I wouldn't get hurt, and gave me the first milk. And by the way, a result of that was bovine tuberculosis, because those cows, they didn't have departments of health then up there, you know. And here these cows had tuberculosis, and I contracted that and got over it, though, although mother said she never expected me to live till I was 6. But we came here in 1893, and I can never forget from that palatial home we had. My mother's conservatory was bigger than the whole house. We had 8 children, by the way. And we got a little house in Philadelphia in one of the courts off Main Street, you know. If you know anything about Philadelphia, you know how it's laid out. Important big homes, you know, on the main streets, the little courts. And there were 3 rooms, one above the other, making it 3 stories high, but 3 rooms. And here was this family who was accustomed to living with our own orchards and our own grain, cows and our own horses, came and lived. And my father was very frustrated. He just couldn't quite accept the change. But my mother was the one who saved the family. She was very charming, very sweet, just did the best she could. It took years for my father to make friends. And what happened, and the reason for it was that one of the first days when he walked out upon the street, a man approached him. And my father came into the house just burning with excitement and disappointment and fear almost. He says, "Why, who do you think came up to me?" And he described this man. He was the horse thief of the town. He said, "I would have crossed the street at home if I saw him coming. And here he came up to me and told me he was the shamus of the shul. You know what the shamus of the shul is? It's like a deacon in a church. After that, he was a very religious man, but he never went to the synagogue or the temple. He prayed every day with his phylacteries up in the bedroom, but never would he join a synagogue or a temple. It was years later when Mother used to say, "Well, the neighbors will talk about you," that he finally went on the high holidays. But all his life, he wouldn't have anything to do with it. Couldn't quite. Of course, it's the sort of snobbish. I once called him an intellectual snob, because nobody could come in the house if there was a shoemaker or a tailor or a carpenter. That was taboo. But if you had something to say, and you were poor as a church mouse, but if you had a brain and you had some information about the world, you were perfectly welcome. It was open house. And of course, when we came here, before we came, something important happened also to influence my father, and that was that in the village where we lived, two men who afterwards became well known in New York, one was Abraham Kahn, who was the editor of the Jewish Daily Forward, and Parn, who was the head of the, who was a labor editor there for years, studied in the village with my brothers. And the authorities were getting after them because they were socialists. And my grandfather, by the way, this is very important advice, laid the plans for the escape of this man, Abraham Kahn. At this time, the village had actually, all his houses had been burnt down by a terrific fire. And there were just some ruins left in ruined houses. And he laid the plans that he should hide in one of his homes for 2 weeks, not run away. And after 2 weeks, they were going to take him to Riga, and he should stay there for 2 weeks. And then he was taken after that time to Hamburg and taken on to America, New York. That was the story of my grandfather, who had been very wealthy and very influential, and yet had the courage to do a thing like that, because had they ever discovered it, he would have been sent off to Siberia. One of my uncles, though, was questioned, a younger brother of my father, and the judge replied in those two brown eyes, "The devil will know the truth." He told him, a man approached him and asked him for a rowboat to cross the river, and he says, well, he thought it was just a friendly thing to do. He didn't know the rowboat. He didn't know him. He certainly did, because of his study.
Yeah. What did your father do when he came to this country?
He couldn't work for anybody. That was below him. So he opened a little grocery store, and I think if it was not for my mother, we would have starved, because nobody was good enough even to sell to.
What did your mother do? She worked in the
She kept store. House and you want me to? She kept house and helped in the store. And as I said, we wouldn't have been able to get along if not for my mother. He was just busy. He discussed things. He had a brilliant memory and a great reader. And I think he remembered every word of the Talmud, the Bible, and applied it. Yeah, Irvine on the committee reminds me of my father, only my father spoke more clearly than he did. Could apply anything to the present day. He had such a vivid knowledge of the Bible and the Talmud. And people loved to come and listen to and talk with him, we had an open house, took him a long time to get accustomed to and accept people in this country.
Now, you went to school, did you go through high school?
Yeah.
And you trained to be an accountant?
I first started with bookkeeping, then I worked in an accountant department, and I also took up courses with the LaSalle Extension people, mm-hmm. And I had some very important positions. Later in life, after I got through with the working for the manufacturers, I turned to the union work because they had asked me to come in with them. And I worked until I got married, then returned to work, and I worked for the Waterproof Garment Workers Union in New York. That was very interesting work during the war because we made the gas masks for the factory. And I would get workers out from one factory and put them in the gas mask factory because then they weren't conscripted, they weren't drafted.
Right. Was the shirtwaist factory the first place you worked?
Yeah, the first place I worked for was a shirtwaist factory. And I'll give you my jobs in chronological order. The first job was given to me as assistant bookkeeper by an uncle to a brother-in-law of mine. He was doing me a great favor. I was going to be paid $4 a week. And I worked for about a half a year for him. That was from 8 in the morning till 6 at night.
What was the name of that firm?
Schatz. Was
that's
the name.
In Philadelphia?
That's in Philadelphia. He was quite a wealthy man. He was, at that time, he was rated 300,000 A credit, I remember. And that was going big in those days. Well, after about four and a half months, I decided that I wasn't quite satisfied with his trying to take care of me. I'd look for a job, and I answered an advertisement, and I got a job factory that made fringes. And I worked there until the boss got tried to get intimate and I left the job after 3 years. That was that. So then I went to work in a shirtwaist factory. And
you remember the name of the factory?
A.F. Stein and Company. It was on 10th near Diamond. And it was in the largest manufacturing building in Philadelphia. It had all kinds of factories there, carpet and the weaving of garments, you know, and the shirtwaist factory. I can still see the little green faces of the children who worked up in the rug factory, you know, carding the wool, and with the pickles in their mouth, you know, they always wanted a pickle in their mouth when they could get it going up the elevator. Mm-hmm. I can still see their little peaked faces to this day. Mm-hmm. But I worked for this firm, and why did I leave there? Oh, I didn't like what was going on between the employer and the forelady, and there was a lot of trouble on account of it. And also, because he had an argument with the foreman, he discharged him. And the foreman was one of the few foremen that I knew that when he discharged him, the people went out on strike because he had been very good. But because he did so, I just left the job and I got another one. And that was for the brother of the Rand people in Philadelphia, were large manufacturers. There were two or three brothers. The president of the manufacturers organization was a brother of the one that I worked for. And I was working during the winter of, this was December, when a general strike in Philadelphia took place. I guess that was called simultaneously with the strike in New York. Mm-hmm. And the reason they had to call these workers out on a general strike was because otherwise the contractors would cut the goods in New York and send it to be finished in Philadelphia.
Right.
That often happens, you know. It even happened later in the garment trades when New York even had to call out Cleveland in the general strike because of they helped
together.
Each other.
Right.
And I was working for this Rand and watching the situation when the girls walked out. It was a bitter winter that year. snow and ice on the ground all the time, and the girls were there out on the pavements, and he was calling in scab workers and paying them more, and I noticed the production was low because I was doing the bookkeeping. And I was questioning him all the time. Finally, I said to him one day, after 6 weeks, I sort of felt things weren't going well for the strikers, and I said, well, I guess this is a lost strike, isn't it? And he said, no, there's no such thing as a lost strike. If they don't succeed in increasing the wage, it instills the stability of the present wage. There's no such thing as a lost strike. Well, that gave
that's
me
from the employer.
That's the employer said that to me. Well, here was my first lesson in trade unionism. And I thought, well, what am I going to do to help the girls? So I went down to the labor union, and I asked them, is there anything that I could do? And they said, well, do you think you can talk before the different locals and collect some money first? Because our treasury is practically bare.
You mean other unions?
Other unions. I said, yes, I would. And when that happened, it was a Wednesday night, or might have been Monday, but Wednesday night I spoke before the Central Labor Union in Philadelphia. And the next morning, the newspapers came out with two columns, my picture and my name. And it was done by a reporter that I wasn't too friendly with on account of some quarrel once in my criticism of him when he tried to criticize my purchasing some prints for a new organization that we had. And I said, what does a $12 a week reporter know about art? I thought I was quite well informed because I had a brother who used to attend the academy, and every night he'd bring home his drawings and go over them with me. And I was appreciative of both music and art. And I owe a lot of credit to him because he always took me out to the symphony and the concerts and discussed art with me. Well, when I saw this in the newspapers, I smiled. All I could do was grin and bear it. And I thought, well, here I'm going to be told to go. Thursday morning, all day Thursday, nothing unusual. Friday, nothing unusual. Saturday morning, towards 12 o'clock, when I would sort of close up, both of the senior partners were out of the office, and oh my heavens, did I omitted something.
Yeah.
Oh, before this happened, I had been at a meeting of the Manufacturers Association. I was taking notes, and one of the manufacturers said, let us give the police some money so that they'll maul up the girl pickets and throw acid in their eyes. And that's what was happening all along. And that's when I went down to the labor organization and told them what I could do for them and gave them the story. They said, well, would you go out and talk to the different locals and try to collect some money? The other organization, I said, yes. And I started to talk, and I was doing so well that the suggestion came up that I go to Washington and perhaps make a plea for arbitration, see some of the authorities there.
Were you working for the union at this point?
No.
So you did this as a volunteer?
This was Thursday and Friday when I first made the told them the story, and they asked me to go out. Mm-hmm. I worked all day Thursday, nothing happened. Friday, nothing happened. And on Saturday morning, the senior partners didn't even appear on the scene, but the son, who never did a thing, that was put in there to ensure his future, that he would be taken in as a partner later, sat there with his feet up on the steam pipes. As I thought, well, I better see that everything's right. And I was careful to see, close my petty cash, and saw that everything was in order. And I said to him with a half smile, half grin, I said, well, you know, I'm going. Goodbye. He says, you know, you're discharged, don't you? I said, well, I expected it. Goodbye. And I walked out. When I walked out, I went down to the Central Labor Body and told them about it. They asked me whether I wouldn't go out on the road that I'd go to Washington and appear before the locals there. I said, well, I'd like to have somebody accompany me, and they appointed another girl's delegate to go out with me. And we went down to Washington.
Isn't that when they danced around?
Oh, yes. When I came and said that gave them the story and told them that I was discharged, there was one man in particular who was called Berger, who was 6'4" and almost as broad as he was tall, just got out into the middle of that floor and began to dance, and there was a dance. And I promised I would go if they give me a girl to go along with. And I went down to Washington, and I was so conscious of the fact that they had no money and how the girls were struggling that I wouldn't even go into a hotel. I asked someone where there were nice rooming houses, and I took a room for $3 a week, and the two of us were there, and I started to make arrangements to go out talking. And I spoke before the locals there, the lithographers, the printers, and they're called the aristocrats of the labor union. Yeah, they're the more intelligent groups. And they responded very enthusiastically. There was quite an excitement. Of course, the newspapers came out with the article immediately, and I thought, well, I must try to arrange arbitration if I can. I wanted to see the president, no less. So I went to the White House, and in those days you could just enter the White House. You would be shown all around. And I didn't get to the president, but I got either an aide or his secretary who came out and said that President Taft feels he can't say anything. He would be showing partiality between capital and labor. So, the newspapers got that story, too. By the way, in Washington, the 10 days I spent there, there were interviews every day with reporters that would wait for me and form a circle around me, and I would report everything that I said and everything that happened. And I'm sure that they still have it in their archives there, in the newspapers.
What was your name then?
I used to be called Ida Mayerson.
Ida Mayerson.
And the reason it's Ida is because when we came here and I was asked my name, I heard a girl in front of me saying Ida, and I didn't know anything else, and I said Ida. It was never my real name. My real name is Nessie.
Isn't that interesting?
And I went through a lifetime with that name, because afterwards, everybody knew me, and I used to, as I said, I used to do a lot of debating when I was really a young cultural organization. And when I got to the unions, of course, I began to write for the International Journal, their labor journal in New York. That Danish was the, and Roseberry. A. Roseberry was the editor of it. He was also from the English School of Labor Leaders. And after the convention, by the way, did I tell you about the convention? No, not yet. I don't have to.
Before,
I should have written it all.
Go on. Could you tell us what, how did people feel about a woman doing public speaking and a woman traveling and playing the kind of role
they accepted it very well, because I seemed to be such a naive little kid, you know.
How old were you then now?
I was just 22, because my birthday is January. And, they accepted it enthusiastically, you know. I came away from Washington after 10 days with $1,000, and that in those days was money, you know. And so many write-ups and so many friends that I made there. I did succeed in speaking to the Department of Commerce, because I had to convince them that it was interstate affairs that were concern because, after all, they manufactured it in Philadelphia, New York. It was shipped to states throughout the Union, and he accepted that. I came out with that story there. I forget what the thing was.
What did your family, what did your parents think of you doing this?
Oh, they accepted it.
Did they?
Yeah.
Were you living at home?
I was living at home, sure. And in fact, later in another, in the car strike when I was arrested, my father said, well, teach her a lesson.
Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like in those factories for the shirtwaist makers?
Well, they worked from 8 till 6. I think they had a half an hour for lunch. The lighting is poor most of the time. It depended upon the factory. It was better to work in the large factories than in the small factories and the contractors. And your work was steadier. If you worked for a small man, you never knew what your season meant. It might mean 6 weeks, and it might mean 8 weeks, and you couldn't get any other work after that. If you worked for a big man, you had more steady work, and you were really better off. And, of course, a lot of these manufacturers who were supposed to be very generous people and gave money to the Hebrew Orphan Asylum got those orphans from the factories. And they worked for 50 cents a week for a half a year. And then they'd be raised maybe 25 cents or a dollar. And they profited that way, too, through their generosity. That went on all the time, especially one man who was very religious that I worked for a short while for. It just made me so angry that I came out and told him what I thought of him and then left the job.
What did the strikers wear?
What?
In terms of, like, what did you wear at that time?
Oh, I remember I had a little woolen dress and a thin stripe like a men's garment, you know. It was blue with a green stripe through it. In fact, I think that's the dress there. It was princess style. And I remember I had another dress in a beautiful blue shade made the same way. I think that's it. That's the dress. See the Dutch collar?
That's the Dutch collar.
I never wore it.
I was
a rebel. I think I was born a rebel.
And did you wear a big hat? We noticed in many of the pictures.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure we wore big hats. I took off my hat then when he took the picture.
You should ask that about the teeth. When women were indoors, like if I came, you know, like we've come to visit you,
yeah.
And then they were, would they leave their hats on when they were visiting?
It depended upon the occasion. Sometimes they wouldn't, sometimes.
If it was a fancy occasion, they would leave it on?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Because they had roses and cherries. Grapes. And everything I remember. I had a big white felt hat. In fact, I think it was the year before this. And they had all colored grapes on it, you know. And the white felt.
I know you mentioned that you spoke both to labor groups and then also to club women. Could you?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was afterwards. When I got out of Washington, came back, they asked me whether I wouldn't go on further. Whether I wouldn't go among the coal miners, who were known to be very generous. And I decided to go, and I went to Scranton, Pennsylvania. And meanwhile, several other girls, friends of mine, tried to do the same thing. There was a group that went to Wilkes-Barre, and they were scattered. And I went to Scranton. It was very interesting there. The miners... I was warned immediately that, I said, well, how will I know the miners? Well, you'll know a miner no matter how much he washes his face. His skin gets glossy, but the coal dust never gets out of his skin. And you'll know them even in the street. And then you used to see them, you know. As I got in, as the train pulled into Scranton, in fact, we saw the miners with their lamps, you know, on their foreheads and their lunch pails walking down the rails there. And the same thing, I didn't take a hotel room again. I took a, went to a rooming house and took a room there so that I could send every penny I could back to the union. And I started to talk there, and they were very generous. I was collecting as much from these poor locals or the miners as I was from the aristocratic locals in Washington, although that was a surprise in those days. And of course I became very interested in the miners. I tried to find out how they lived and how they felt. And you know, every miner's home that you'd come into, you'd see a picture of John Mitchell, one of their presidents, you know. In fact, they say that when they would take them to become citizens, they often got the answer when they would be asked who's president of the United States. They'd say John Mitchell. That was a comeback of theirs. And I had about $1,000 that I got from the Scranton people when the president's central labor body came on the platform one night, and he says, you know, she has just cause, and she's spoken of it very well, but you know, we've depleted our treasuries, and we have a strike of our mill girls here for the last 5 months, and we've got to learn, come back and take care of them. So then I thought it was time to get out. But that night, an old miner, he was 84 years old, he had worked in the salt mines of Austria from the time he was 9 years. Came here, and he was one of those who was considered rich among them. He had bought a house where he had a meeting room for the town people. And that town was Taylor, about 12 miles from Scranton. He says, you know, if you have time, come out, and I'll give you the law free any time you have. And I'll see that the people come out to hear you. So I looked in my time book, and I saw that the only time I had left was Sunday morning. Now, Scranton, I guess you found about 6 feet of snow and ice on the ground. But I came out, 10 o'clock. Every shutter in that village was closed tight. I thought, oh, my God, what's this? I knocked at the door, and an old man, this old man, you know, the flannel underwear that they used to wear, and you know how uppity we girls were at that time. Sex was something far removed from us. He came out in this full underclothes, you know, it wasn't great, it was bright, though. He said, come in, me gals. My wife will make you some breakfast, and then I'll open up the hall, and they'll be here. Well, we came in, and there she busied herself with toast and bacon, I think it was, and eggs, and we had a hot breakfast. And I waited and waited, and finally a few came in, you know. The town had just closed out, it was so full of ice and snow, and I left. But before I left Scranton, I spoke to the people about the miners. I was very interested by that time in them. They said they were very honest and very generous. That if a man would, if a woman would come in and they'd want to sell her some goods, she'd say no. The man goes down deep, deep every day, and I don't know if he'd come up again. And they would refuse to buy unless they could pay for it. But then the club women, thought, the president of the women's club there, called me in. And she was the wife of the society doctor there, Dr. Wainwright. Beautiful woman. Very uppity-uppity in her mannerisms. And she asked me about him, but never arranged to do anything or give anything. Why she wanted to know that, I don't know. The only other pleasant thing I remember about the town is that one night when I went to hold a meeting in the town, on a big hill covered with ice and snow, some little kids that were sledding came up to me. We saw your picture in the papers. And I never knew how they could even recognize it, because we had big fur coat on, you know, snow, cap over our, fur cap, over our heads, you know, and hat, rather, it wasn't a cap. But they did, and they spoke to us a while, and I went on sledding, and I went on to the meeting. So that was my experience in Scranton. Of course, the newspaper man there was a very fine chap, and he used to call me in to write up the stories and ask me to come in and write up the story for the Sunday edition. And when I did, I wrote up enough for a half a page. And as he looked at it, he laughed and put, "Let's do pencil marks through your writing and through my own." And we kept in touch with each other sometime. In fact, he visited Philadelphia a few months later when the general car strike happened there, which I was interested to. But at that time, I was working. I came back from the trips, and the strike was settled. Cry went out among all the workers. Of course, we wanted her as our secretary. And I was without a job. I'd been discharged and floating around. And I accepted it. I worked about 4 or 5 months when Johnny Dyche, the general secretary of the International, came down, listened to me, watched my work, and he said, "I think I want this woman in my office." And I came down as assistant to the secretary treasurer of the International. And by the way, my wages that he offered me were $4 more than he was getting until the next convention, which is very funny. Talk about women's lib. I was getting $22 and he was getting $18. Then the next, and I used to be sent out on organizing trips to New Jersey, Connecticut when I was there. Working in the office at night, I'd go out organizing. And then, of course, I remarked before that my husband was sent down as an organizer for the, he wasn't my husband then, we met there, as an organizer for the local in Philadelphia. And when I gave up my job and he followed me after the convention to New York again, I gave the job to, the organizing job was given to Pauline A. Newman, who was well known in New York, in the Women's Trade Union League, along with Rose Schneiderman and the Dreyer sisters. Who
could you tell us a little bit about them? Was Pauline a shirtwaist maker?
She was originally a shirtwaist maker. I was the tradeswoman. When I became secretary, I had to change the constitution of that organization, of that local. In fact, they had to do it afterwards, too, in another local where I was. I was always by appointment. I couldn't come in as a, because I wasn't a tradeswoman.
How old were people like Pauline Newman?
Well, Pauline Newman was about 5 or 6 years older than I was. And Rose Schneiderman was about the same age, I think. Maybe a few years younger.
So they were in their middle 20s?
Right? Yeah, they were in there. More or less late 20s, I think. And that was it. Well, of course, that is past the shirtwaist strike that I came in. But I finished my shirtwaist experience with being called to New York to assist Johnny Dice's assistant.
Could you tell us what, I was just curious, you know, when the shirtwaist makers were on strike in Philadelphia, what were their picket lines? Did they carry signs?
Oh, yes, carried signs.
Do you remember what any of them said?
No, that I can't remember. I guess strike. Nothing like that. I remember there were bitter fights with the police before the newspaper story came out, you know, that they had been given handfuls of money to throw acid in the eyes of the girls and to maul up the pickets on the line. Oh, that story really carried far, and that story was repeated. And every time I spoke, I told the story of what had happened, how I came in on the strike, and why. And it was after that that we really built up a large local, both in Philadelphia, New York. New York had been a large local, but that built up a lot. I think their membership increased from 1,000 to about 10,000.
Well, some of them were very young. Is that right? Some of the women were?
Well, I wouldn't say that. Some of them were in their 20s. There were some men among them, too, you know. Mm-hmm. And they really represented a more intellectual class than those that went into other trades. The cigar makers and the waste makers and garment workers were known as the more intellectual workers.
Why was that?
Why was that? Yeah. I think because, maybe the conditions were better in those places than they were in other factories. It was cleaner, you know, after all you sat down the machine. I know a woman who turned to nursing afterwards and then came back again to work at the machine because she said, I can sit and dream while the machine's running along. And I suppose that affected a lot of workers that way. And then, of course, the men, every man that started to work in a garment factory in Sherwood was dreaming of the time when he'll become a foreman, and then a contractor, and then a big boss. Mm-hmm. They always had that view, the men did, and they did. That's what happened. So many of them. The women remained workers, or four ladies, or married, and that was it. Well, you know what the pay was? They worked for about $4 a week, $4.50 a week. They worked piecemeal work, most of them, you know. And $6 is a lot of money, or $8 in the busy season is a lot of money. That's what they worked for. Few of them averaged over there. Among the men's garment workers, there's some that had more. Well, there's a story that I can tell about that that's funny, too, where the statisticians had to steal. I worked afterwards with a statistician that was appointed to audit the books, you know, in the men's strike. They had to steal the books to get at the deal because I had two sets of books, one for inspection and one that they used to pay their workers with. And they actually stole the books. This was a well-known statistician, and when I was working there with him, did some part-time work, he said, wouldn't it be a nice story if they found who had stolen the books, that it was a statistician. And that was the only way they could prove that the pressers were averaging only $4.50 a week instead of $12 in the manufacturers.
When you did public speaking, you didn't have microphones. Right.
No. Spoken I had a pretty good speaking voice. Well, I had practiced. I told you I was the crack and jack debater of the group. That's after I got out of high school. Up to that time, I was the shyest thing I had. My head in a book all the time, excepting to socializing with the friends, the dilettantes that my brother traveled with, you know, artists and writers and things like that. Otherwise, my head was in a book.
Did people back then, when they did public speaking, did they use their hands a lot, or did they? Do you remember?
Some didn't. Some didn't.
What about yourself?
I don't think so. I think I had a story to tell, and I told it. Mm-hmm. And that's what people said, and it was believable. That's why I got what I got. And that's why the results were so good. And I actually accomplished what I set out to do. That helped really settle the strike in Philadelphia. And when that strike was settled, the strike in New York would be settled.
In New York, after the Triangle Fire in 19...
I remember the Triangle... Oh, that was later. But it was after the strike was settled.
Right.
Because I know I was married at the time. It was just after I married. Remember that?
I know in New York there was a big mass meeting called after that fire. Was there one in Philadelphia too?
Oh, there were meetings all over. That was never forgotten for years and years. And
such a horrible thing. And the reason for it was that they, I know even the factories where I worked, they locked the doors and they weren't supposed to. Because they were afraid that somebody would steal something and take it out here on the back bay. So the doors were locked. So that upstairs.
Were you in New York when the Triangle Fire occurred?
Yeah.
Did you participate in the large march they had on the
I don't New York think session? So. I really don't know. Was I in New York or not? I can't. Or whether I was. I think I was visiting my mother at that time. I don't think I was in New York. Oh yes, Brownie. You want to open the door? Sure. Because he'll just keep at it. The most eventful things were really the strike, the general strike in the clothing trade in 1910. That was all the workers, you know, the dress people, not only the shirt waist people. That's the time that I met Meyer London and Brandeis. I'll never forget the garment strike when they had a meeting, you know. They felt they were losing, and they had a meeting of an agreement between the manufacturers and the labor people, because Meyer Lund came into them. He says, you know, we've got only $300 in the treasury and $1,000 a day. And that strike to be carried on. What are we going to do? And he said, they framed this contract, you know, and when they took it back to the workers wouldn't ratify it. But they didn't know, the manufacturers, that there was only $300 in the treasury of the union. So negotiations were reopened, and a much better agreement after a week or so was signed. But I'll never forget that. What are we going to do? Marlon, who was beloved by the workers in New York City, he was the attorney. I remember when I had to use him later for an organization, I said, we have no money. He said, oh, you'll pay me when you have money. He was never questioned that. He afterwards became congressman, yeah, from the Socialist Party. But he was very simple, very lovable, honest person. Brandeis was in to the office then several times, I remember him very well. Oh, Brownie, you just came in. Yeah, I know. He talks to you. Suppose there's a dog on the ground. Then the waistmaker went on, and it resulted in the unemployment insurance fund, the first unemployment insurance fund. I authorized the first check that was ever issued in this country on unemployment. The first authorization went out. And that was destroyed afterwards by infighting in the union. When the fight between the lefts and the rights of the unions took place, after 3.5 years, they threw back $2.5 million to the employers. Never forgive them for that. Because I remember the old men with their beards coming to the window and being so thankful that at least this summer they won't be evicted.
Could you talk a little bit about the women who were actually out on the picket line, about what they were like and what kind of things they had to deal with and what kind of circumstances?
Well, the greatest ambition was of a girl was to be able to save up money to buy a big ostrich feather for her. And you'd be surprised how they worked to finally get that ostrich feather. And afterwards, the manufacturer said, see, those girls are well-dressed. Look at their hats with their ostrich feathers. That's why I brought out that item. Oh, they could all sew, so they made their own clothes. They never really looked shabby. They were like all the young immigrants that came over, eager. Some of them were pretty, some were not. Some were in their 20s.
Most of them single and living with their family.
Yeah. except for working in the factory together and stuff. The girls look forward to marrying and getting away from it all. Men look forward to becoming manufacturers and so.
You were in jail briefly.
Oh, that was a car strike. That occurred when I was secretary of the Lacemakers in Philadelphia. I remember that was a bitter strike.
When was that?
In 1910.
It
got so bitter that in the working districts, Kensington, for instance, the women burned any car that came out on the streets. They set fire to them, the wives of the men. By the way, the woman that used to accompany me in Washington came up. The editor of that newspaper came up. There were lots of people that came up there to see what was going on. The day I was arrested, I was having lunch in Bennett's, I remember, on 9th Street between Chestnut Market. And I came out, and it was the day when the marchers marched from Independence Hall to City Hall. Perfectly organized, quiet march. And the word had gone out from City Hall to send out the police and just pounce on them. And just as I walked out of the restaurant, I saw a policeman batting away at a man with blood trickling down. And all that I did was grab his arm, leave him alone. That was interfering with the police. And by the way, the strike was so awful that we had martial law. You didn't dare to send anything. So I was put in jail, and I couldn't even be bailed under martial law for interfering with the police. But the story got out. That happened on the street right near the Central Labor Body, where everybody knew me. Where I was still the toast of the town. The car went out, I was nurses with. So the jail was filled with flowers and candy, because the police had a wonderful time. Well, by this time, some of the society women were interested in the car strike in Philadelphia, and they thought they had landed a society day. You know. The night time came. The police brought me out, clean blankets and coffee. Oh, you're not used to this. But in the morning, the story appeared in the newspaper for all the work I had done for the waste makers. And they came out to me, oh, you deserve to be where you are. So I thought, oh, I'm going to get it. But by the time I have to go to trial in the morning, there were people from New York already, too, that come over, you know, to plead and say, what a generous and quiet person I've been, all that, this and that, but I got 30 days suspended. And I tell you, I bore that all my life. I had to cover it up many times when I did so. I got away with it.
You mentioned, a couple times you were. We have a scene between the rich ladies and the strikers in our play. We have a scene in our play.
Oh,
between the rich
ladies. Now then you go back to the Women's League in New York. They used to come over to Philadelphia to make teas and hand out cookies and tea for the girl and coffee for the girls. And now and then have a singer or something. They came over. The Dyer sisters were in it, and that was an organization that Mrs. Roosevelt was interested in. By the way, the organization was just about a block or two away from the old Roosevelt home. It was around 20th and 21st Street that they were at their old home. They'd come down, and try to put some spirit into the girls that they were with them, And they made their slight contribution, I suppose. In New York, they were busy all the time, They would send over food to the halls where the strikers were meeting.
Did they give money as well?
I think they gave money, too. That was the Dyer sister, D-W-I-E-R. There were two of them.
Margaret and Mary.
I don't remember their first names, but I remember the guys. I remember them, too. Sweet-looking young women. In their 30s, I think they were. I remember them.
They never came out on the line, though.
No, they never came out on the line. They were there, they'd come into their halls where they were meeting and would send down food, like cookies and maybe sandwiches.
Mary Dreyer was arrested on the line in New York once.
What?
Mary Dreyer was arrested once on the picket line
in New York.
Was she in New York?
because it got in the paper since she was a rich lady. And that what had happened is the policeman said to her, if I'd known you was a rich lady, I wouldn't have arrested you. So that was, you know, that was very important.
Well, they came down to Philadelphia too, so that's that.
Did you meet Agnes Nestor? She was Agnes Nestor. She came from Chicago to help in the Philadelphia shirtwaist strike.
I don't remember her. You see, I got into this thing in peculiar ways. It was right, spontaneous. Just burst out of me.
What do you remember about Rose
Hyman? Oh, she was a very swell person. I never liked her. She was negative. And I suppose there are other things I was annoyed about. I wanted to go in the air. She was a lesbian. You know, I couldn't take it. But Rose Schneider was, oh, she was swell.
She was little, right?
Yeah, a little girl. Red haired. Slight wave in her hair. To get a bear. So, yeah, we all had, I had a beautiful head. Black hair used to be called the girl with the raven hair. But Rose Schneider was a different type of person. Very soft tone, very generous sort of person. In fact, I think she helped support her family. And she was one that everybody loved. All you had to do is to know her and you loved her. She was afterwards, wasn't she a cabinet member or an assistant to Frances Perkins?
I don't know that. I don't know.
I know she was in the in Washington in the law, in an important position, but I don't remember just what the position was like. And she deserved it. I was so glad she got it. Because for years, oh, by the way, I don't think she was a lace maker. I think she was a glove maker.
Or a cap maker.
No, she was a glove maker.
Glove maker.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to remember things all of a sudden. When you were 22 and I'm 86, it's just a little, a lot of things have happened since then. But I think I always had my sympathy. One of the things I can remember was I was no more than 7 or 8 years old. My mother and a neighbor were sitting. They were crocheting and drinking coffee. And there was a strike of stockage workers in Philadelphia. And the woman said to my mother, they have no right to strike. They ought to thank the boss for giving them work. And my mother said, he needs them as much as they need him. So that's something I learned at my mother's knee, I think. Most of the Socialist Party members in Philadelphia used to come into our house, you know, and take the virtues of socialism. Our house was an open house, as long as you had something to say.
Did Rose Schneider come to Philadelphia?
Oh, yes. She visited many times. So did Paul Newman. In fact, my husband, when he left Philadelphia to join me in New York afterwards, gave the position to her. And the odd thing is that I gave my position to a girl who was a cousin of a woman that taught my son afterwards. The Rance people, you know. The girl I gave to was Jenny Rance, Mary Rance. So she taught my boy in a private school where he had scholars. So, you can always... Yeah. World's very small. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was a very busy kid. I remember preparing a man for his civil service examination. He was at 38 years old, and that's just 12 years old. And he passed. Later on, I taught a lot of immigrants free of charge. We had an organization where we had an enrollment of 600 pupils. Just a group of young people. You know, when I hear people say today, well, there's nothing for them to do, that's why they're turning to drugs, that's right. Look what we did. We were in high school or out, or some are just starting college. And we taught 4 nights a week. And on the 5th night, we had lecturers there for them. And we used to come right from our supper table to this school and taught till 10 o'clock at night. How long did you work for the unions? I worked for the unions after I came back to work again. I worked for the unions, let's see, about a half a year with Local 10, and about a half a year with the International, or 9 months, something like that. And then when I came back, I got a position. When I came back, I was given a position right away, but the union was in an awful state, International. There's a time when 7 of their people were in jail for the supposed murder of a boss, you know, an employer. And I could have been a witness there for, but I didn't go. I was there when they came back, made a statement. And I came back to work years after, about almost 4 years afterwards.